Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Jean Carroll case. For some reason, you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way. You can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes, and please give this podcast an Andy McCarthy, the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. Our sponsor of this episode, by the way, is Free the Economy, the new podcast from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I heard you guys on the editors talking about Aaron Rodgers with Jim.
Yes.
Which is cool, but I don't know what it is about it, but I haven't been able to get whipped up about it yet. Maybe it's because
too old, or just not the season to be into football.
I think it's not the season. I was kind of put off by the whole thing. I actually thought they should have gone for a younger guy, but I don't want to give up hope on Wilson. So maybe if he could learn under Rodgers for a year or two, he'll come back and he'll be better, and it'll all come out well in the end. I just I wasn't sure last year. Now I hear Rodgers had a thumb issue, which I didn't know. Actually, I don't think I knew it until I heard you and Jim talk about it. But I didn't think he was into it last year. You know, there were at least some reporting out there that he showed up kind of not really in game shape. So, you know, if he comes with a chip on his shoulder and he really thinks he's going to finally do the Joe Namath win the Super Bowl thing, it'll be interesting. But I just maybe if the Mets can start beating the Nationals, I'll be able to focus. The other thing I would say, though, Rich, I know we got to get to other things, but man, I watched the Knicks at the Garden last week. I hadn't watched the Knicks in, I don't know, 10 years, but there is nothing like Madison Square Garden when the Knicks are good.
You were at the Garden?
No. I watched it from. But I mean, the energy and the electricity of it. There's nothing. I mean, I remember Shea Stadium when the Mets won the World Series, and I was in Yankee Stadium when Chambliss hit the home run, and the building shook. So I've seen that kind of stuff, but I mean, the Garden when the Knicks are good, there's just nothing like it.
Yeah, so they won that series, and they were good at the end of the year. I've never been an NBA guy. I briefly went through, and I have no NBA team, but I briefly went through a Knicks phase. This is kind of ancient history now, but during the Linsanity era, for about the 3-week period, I was watching Knicks games because it was so much fun while it lasted. Yeah. So this is a story. I think we talked about this last episode or an episode or two ago. That ordinarily you'd expect former presidential candidate, leading candidate for a major party nomination, who has a rape case going against him. It would be, you know, front page news. It would be the top of every cable show. But this Jean Carroll case has not gotten much attention because there's just so much other static out there in general, and of course about Trump in particular. But we're today going to walk through this thing, which started this week. So introduce us to the basic contours.
So I confess, Rich, to not paying this enough attention, I think. And I was trying to, as you say, it's such an unusual, I mean, it's a Trump story, but it's still so, I mean, it just sounds so, even given the Trump factor, it sounds so crazy that, you almost think it can't be real. And then I watched E. Jean Carroll, who is the plaintiff in this case, who claims that Trump raped her at Bergdorf Goodman. She's now, she was back and forth about whether it happened in 1995 or 1996. I think she's now reconstructed it such that she believes it happened in the spring of 1996. But she, she was on CNN with Anderson Cooper, I want to say like about a year ago, maybe more than that, when this first started to get a lot of attention. And I thought she came off as, you know, kind of flaky. He asked her, why, something along the lines of why men engage in rape. And she said something along the lines of, they think it's sexy. It's sex. And she sounded like kind of crazy saying it. And then when I looked at the transcript of what she said and the fullness of the interview, it actually wasn't, in context, what she said was not as bad or as crazy as it sounded, but the snippet didn't do well. And it also looked bad because Anderson Cooper, I think, wanted to portray her in as favorable a light as he could. And he ended up cutting to a commercial in the middle of when she was sounding a little bit flaky. So I think that added to the impression that she was something of a nutcase. And then, of course, Trump, jumped right in. And I think did a pretty good job publicly of kind of portraying her as a nutty person who was not to be believed. But I have to say, now looking at this very closely and allowing for the fact that however she presents in a television interview, she's a talented journalist. She's been a writer she wrote for Elle magazine and an advice column there for about 20 years. She used to be on media a lot, not that I ever saw, but some local New York media in the 80s and 90s. She's a good writer, so you would expect that she would write a complaint with the assistance of her lawyers that tells a very interesting story. You know, a lot of legal papers that you read are kind of dry. Hers is a very interesting narrative. So she brings a writer's talent, at least to the telling of the story. But now looking at it from beginning to end, I would just say a couple of things generally, and then we can get into the specifics. But there's more to the story than I thought, because there's a couple of contemporaneous reports and those witnesses are going to testify. And there's not, even if they despise Trump, there's not any obvious reason why they would risk committing perjury. And then I guess because I was always a criminal prosecutor, and I never did I've had cases where witnesses had sexual assault issues, but I never did a sexual assault case. It doesn't come up very often in federal law. So there's been some important developments in the law where I think they've made some tweaks in the law of evidence to try to make it a little bit easier to prove sexual assault claims, because I think what they were finding was that in many, many of these cases, and this goes back to the Catholic Church scandal, and then we have the Me Too stuff. I think what they were finding was that in most of these cases, sometimes decades have gone by, but certainly like many years go by before people come forward. As a result, there really isn't any forensic evidence to speak of in a lot of these cases. So they've tweaked the rules of evidence to allow things in these cases which you would not ordinarily be able to prove in a trial, including propensity evidence, which we can also talk about. So I think, there's more to this case, and Trump's got a higher risk of being found. I keep saying guilty because I'm from the criminal law world, but he's got, there's a pretty good chance he could be found criminally liable here. I think it all sort of depends on how, it probably depends on today, because as you and I are speaking right now, I believe Jean Carroll is being cross-examined by Trump's lawyer, Joe Tacopina, in the trial today. And that'll probably go on all day and maybe into tomorrow. And I would imagine that how that goes will probably say a lot about how this turns out.
Mm-hmm. So the allegation is that she was at Bergdorf correct me if I'm wrong about some of this, I will be. She was leaving. Trump comes in. He recognized her because, as you say, they ran the same circles. She, you know, had an advice column. She had some prominence in the media. And he says, you're the advice lady. And he's like, hey, you're the media tycoon. And he says, look, I'm buying something for a girlfriend. You know, help me out. Look through some handbags or whatever. And then he says, yo, you know what? I want to get some lingerie, and picks out a piece of lingerie. And he says, you know, why don't you put it on and model it for me? And she's, no, why don't you model it for me? And then he directs her into a dressing room, and she thinks this is all still good fun, and then rapes her. And, you know, 3 minutes later, she runs from the, you know, she pushes him away eventually and runs away, you know, out of Bergdorf, calls these friends, decides not to report it, feels embarrassed, feels she was stupid playing along with this. One friend says, call the police, and she says, I'm not going to do that. Another friend says, you know, just forget it happened.
Yeah, that's basically what happens. And she goes with the advice of the second friend, who, interestingly, a lot of these people, Rich, if you grew up in New York around the time I did, a lot of these people are fairly well-known media people in this particular big fishbowl here in New York and the New York area. But the friend who strongly advised her to follow her instincts and not go to the police and not report it was Carol Martin, who is a newscaster in New York. And the friends that she reported this to are both people that who are fellow journalists who she knew from those circles. So the woman that she immediately reports it to is a woman by the name of Lisa Birnbach. And Lisa Birnbach was a writer at New York Magazine. And her testimony is going to be very important in the case because, number one, she gets the immediate call after this happens. Carol calls her right away, Lisa Birnbach. She's still out on the street. And in fact, as they will evidently both testify, she was still both panting, and she said that her, I guess everybody has a different kind of nervous reaction when they go through something like she says she went through. And she said that her thing was that she was laughing maniacally, mm-hmm. and that she couldn't control herself, like she couldn't get a grip on that. And she remembers distinctly that was her decorum in this call. Birnbach apparently remembers it the same way. So she's the one, Rich, Birnbach is, who gets the immediate call from virtually, like, supposedly right after this thing happened. She's still out on, you know, Fifth Avenue someplace. Bergdorf's is on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And apparently, Lisa Birnbach will testify that she pleaded with E. Jean Carroll to go to the police to report it. And Carroll's response was, you know, look, it was terrible, but it was quick and it's over. And I never have to, I just don't want to do that. I don't want to, you know, she was, according to her, as you just said, you know, feeling like, understand this, she was not a young girl at this point in time, right? She's a 52-year-old woman when this thing happens. Trump is about 49. In fact, she says that some of the banter that she had with Trump, who may not even have known her name, as you say, you know, he said to her, you're the advice lady. There's no evidence at the time that Trump knew her name, at least the way that she tells the story. What she would say and has said is that he recognized her instantly, but didn't necessarily know her by name. And of course, he has since then disclaimed knowing her and even ever seeing her before, until there was some photographic evidence that refuted that we can come to. But the other interesting thing about this Lisa Birnbach is she was at New York Magazine, and she wrote a profile of Trump and Melania at Mar-a-Lago, which I think was called Mi Casa, Su Casa,
And the reason that that's of any relevance, aside from the fact that it's interesting that Carol calls her, the relevance, I think, of it is twofold. One is they will both, I think, testify that the reason that she called Birnbach, she has a number of friends, but the reason she chose to call Birnbach first is that she knew that Birnbach was working on a piece about Trump for New York Magazine. And the piece that Birnbach published, or that New York Magazine published of Birnbach's, came out in their February 12th, 1996 issue. So you would think that that has been an important fact as Carol has tried to reconstruct when this happened, because she has a lot of trouble fixing the date or even the approximate date of this.
So, Andy, let me pause and share this message from our sponsor this episode, our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I want to tell everyone about a new podcast from CEI. It's called Free the Economy, and it's about how we can all be happier, healthier, and wealthier in a world with less government control. From legalizing the gig economy to the perils of ESG and what true diversity in the workplace looks like, each week, CEI's Free the Economy podcast brings you up to speed on news you can use and welcomes experts in their fields to have honest and candid conversations about how these policies and more shape our economy and society. America has the greatest economy in the world, but it could be even stronger if we embraced a free society where innovation and entrepreneurship were encouraged and not shackled with bureaucratic controls. Check out Free the Economy wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CEI.org/freetheeconomy. Again, it's Free the Economy. You can find it anywhere, all the podcasting platforms, or just check it out at CEI.org/freetheeconomy. So, Andy, this is one of these cases. You know, it's 20 years old, so, you know, we're very likely never going to know. The contemporaneous accounts, I would think, mean a lot, because to call up and lie to someone about this, you know, and pretend to be very upset would be, you know, truly demented behavior that would evidence itself in other ways, and everyone you'd think would be aware of. On the other hand, you know, if someone says Trump groped them, I believe it. If someone says, you know, within limits, if someone says, you know, Trump kissed me without notice, I believe it. Someone says Trump, you know, I had an affair with Trump, I believe it. You know, not every single, but that's kind of the pattern within his known behavior. This would be to do this in a very public place, even if she says that that no one was on the lingerie floor. How is Trump going to know this? I mean, this is an enormous risk, a violent act, not just kind of a sexually aggressive act, but a true act of violence that he, for all he knew, someone could have walked in while he was committing it. So all of that makes me skeptical.
Yeah, and I think skepticism is a good thing to come to the table with on this. I do think your reaction, Rich, is interesting, because I think we should jump ahead in addressing that to why Judge Kaplan is allowing these other women to testify, because I think this goes exactly to the point that you're making. So in this case, because I should back up and explain to people, ordinarily, the federal rules of evidence do not permit what's known as propensity evidence. And that is the idea that, let's say, you're accused of robbing a bank in, you know, July of 2023. I'm prosecuting you. I want to show that you have a prior criminal record where you've committed three robberies in like the 5 years before the bank robbery, right? Ordinarily, the court will not allow that testimony, because you're not supposed to have a jury find someone guilty in a criminal case or liable in a civil case on the theory that they have a propensity to commit bad acts. That is to say, they did bad things in the past, so they must have done the thing that they're charged with here. So there are some bases that you're allowed to bring propensity evidence in. I don't want to confuse things by going into them. I just want to like lay out the principle that ordinarily you can't convict or find somebody guilty of the thing that's charged because they allegedly did similar things in the past right. that aren't charged. That's the general principle. As I said, as we began our conversation, that principle has been loosened in connection with sexual assault cases, at least in the civil context. You can't do this in criminal cases, but in a civil case, the court is allowed to let in some propensity evidence if there is an allegation of, if the main charge in the case is an allegation that involves sexual assault. And I believe that the reason that that has been done is because there have been so many of these cases, and obviously this Me Too movement, it was very strong politically for a time, but a lot of this I think is backlash from the Catholic Church's scandal. But you have a lot of these cases where, because of what you just laid out, how, you know, 20 years ago, no physical evidence, no forensic proof, I think they want to even the playing field for people who actually authentically have claims of, you know, that they were sexually abused as children or as young people, or even in Jean Carroll's case at the age of 52. But for a variety of reasons, that many of which are very good reasons, they don't come forward, and that by the time they get to trial, they don't have forensic evidence. So if this evidence is available, I think what the other thing the legislatures that have put these kind of provisions have found, I think, is that men in particular who engage in this kind of behavior, it's usually not a one-off.
Right.
You know, with Harvey Weinstein, for example, there were, you know, was it dozens of women who came yep. forward, maybe more than that? Bill Cosby, the same thing. Yep. And as we know, when this, you know, Access Hollywood thing came out, there were a bunch of women who came forward about Trump, two of whom we're about to talk about. So I think that's the reason they let this evidence in. Now, to go to your point, the two women who are going to testify, one is called Jessica Leeds, who claims that Trump groped her on an airplane. And this is important to what
like,
you just...
This is the one who said like he was like an octopus, right?
Yeah, but the important thing, it's a little fact, but in this case, it might turn out to be a very important fact. It's that they're on an airplane with other people on it. Trump kind of nudges her into a room, and then he does the same thing that Jean Carroll claims he did, which is that he turned around, he shut the door so that he is between the woman and the door. No one can get in, and no one can, and the, you know, the woman is kind of pinned. So that's what happened. That's what Jessica Leeds is going to testify happened to her. And then there is this Natasha Stoynoff, who is yet another journalist in this story. She's a People magazine reporter, and she alleges that Trump assaulted her at Mar-a-Lago when she was down there to do a story about Trump and Melania's first wedding anniversary.
Yep.
This
fits the pattern.
So she says that, you know, he's a big guy, as we know, and he, you know, he physically kind of bullied her into the position and forced a kiss on her. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, started telling her that they were going to have an affair and it was going to be great and all that stuff. So here's what Judge Kaplan says about letting these Lewis Kaplan is the judge on this case. And I do want to talk about him because I think he may be the X factor for Jean Carroll. But what he says is, in each case, the alleged victim claims that Mr. Trump suddenly attacked her sexually. In the cases of Ms. Carroll and Ms. Stoynoff, he allegedly did so in a location after closing a door behind him, which gave him privacy. In all three cases, he allegedly did so without consent. And then, to the point of Stoynoff saying that he forced a kiss on her, the judge is also letting Carroll play for the jury a portion of the infamous Access Hollywood case. And in particular, I think what he's going to direct attention to is where Trump says, I don't want to get into the, you know, awful graphic thing that he said at the end, but he does say, and this could be very relevant, I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. When you're a star, they let you do it. You could do anything. So what they want to, what she wants to argue is that the behavior that she's going to be able, or that she's going to try to prove at trial, matches up to Trump's description of his exploits. And I think that if the jury believes that, if the jury believes that connection, it's not a big leap to believe the rest of what Trump said on the XS Hollywood case, which if the tape, which if they believe is going to help her prove her case. At least that's, I think, what their plan is. So the point that you raise is the important point. Like, why would he engage in this kind of risky behavior? And what she's going to say is, he's done it before. He's done it a number of times. It's out of his own mouth. He says he does it. Mm-hmm. Now, as you point out, this is an assault of a different degree, because she claims it was an actual rape, whereas these never got that far. Although I guess the implication is it could have gotten that far with Jessica Leeds. So anyway, that's why that evidence is coming in. It could end up being important.
So what exactly is the defamation? And let's say the jury finds for Carol, is that just by implication of a kind of finding of guilt on the underlying charge, or is it just they don't think she's a whack job, you know, as Trump called her? Or what will they actually be deciding on?
So there's a sort of a labyrinthine procedural history to all this, but to boil it down as simply as I can, Carol tells her story publicly in 2019 while Trump is still president. At that point, the statute of limitations for rape in New York is long past, right? Because she's saying this happened in 1996, right? As we sit here today, it's like 27 years ago, right? So when she initially published her story, she wrote a book, and the Trump excerpt was actually, the book came out, I think, July, or first week of July in 2019, but New York Magazine did the first excerpt on Trump in June of 2019. So Trump attacks her rhetorically as president. There's three different times when he makes statements about her, says, you know, she's a whack job, she's a liar, she's bringing me into this to try to sell a book, and this never happened. I don't even know her, which is, I think it's going to hurt him that he said that, because they can prove that he met her because of this photograph. But to just like be clear on what's charged. So she can't at that point file a rape claim, but she instead files a defamation claim that he's lying about her in a very aggressive, unseemly way about her story. And she's not the only one who did this, Rich. There are a number of women who, especially in the early parts of the Me Too stuff, when they came forward, the statute of limitations on sexual assault had passed. When the men involved denied it, what they would do is sue them for defamation, which is a way to get to prove the sexual assault at trial and get some damages out of it, right? So she files her suit in New York court, New York State court, in 2019. Trump is president at the time that he says these things about her, about she's lying and all that stuff. So at that point, the Justice Department moves to get the case transferred to federal court. That's why it's in front of Judge Lewis Kaplan in the Southern District of New York, the Manhattan Federal Court. And what the Justice Department in the Trump administration, and by the way, this is not just a Trump position. The Biden Justice Department has continued to maintain this position. They took the position that when Trump denied Carol's allegations, that was in the course of his duties as president, that the president, even if he did it in a coarse and offensive way, that the president has to respond to these sorts of things for a variety of reasons, and therefore this should be deemed to be in the ambit of his duties as president. And the importance of that, Rich, is if they're right about that, then what happens is the United States gets substituted for Trump as a defendant. So Trump is out of the case. The United States is the case under the doctrine of law that's known as respondeat superior, which is just if you're working for someone when you commit a tort or a crime, the person you're working for can be, or the entity you're working for can be held responsible for it, right? So the importance here is if the United States is substituted, the doctrine of sovereign immunity applies, and Congress has not consented for the United States to be sued for defamation. So if a court found that Trump was acting within the scope of his duties when he denied her claims, the case is over. The defamation case would be thrown out of court. So that's all being litigated in the federal courts. Judge Kaplan looks at this claim and he says, I don't think so. I don't think what he did here is not within the scope of presidential duties. The Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit, looked at what Kaplan did and said, I'm not sure we agree with this. However, they vacated his ruling, but they didn't substitute their own. Instead, they decided to throw it in the court of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which is different from the D.C. Circuit Federal Court. So they handle a lot of employment stuff in the District of Columbia. So the Second Circuit certified to that court a question saying, what are the scope of the president's duties, and is what Carroll alleges here, is that within the scope of presidential duties? And of course, naturally, no one wants to decide this, right? Except for Judge Kaplan. The DC Court of Appeals looks at this, and they tell the Second Circuit, we'll accept your certified question, we'll handle it. And then they get back to them and they say, number one, we don't think it would be appropriate for us to define the scope of the President of the United States' duties. And number two, this is a very fact-intensive question. So at this early stage of the proceeding, there's no way we could decide this. So in other words, this is all getting bounced back and forth among the courts, and they haven't decided the question of, is this within the scope of presidential duties? In the meantime, two things happen. One, New York, reacting to Me Too, enacts a reprieve of the statute of limitations for sexual assault. For one year, they waive the statute of limitations. So anyone who has a claim that would have been time barred from November 24th of last year until this year, November 24th, they can file the claim. So the day after that window opens, Jean Carroll amends her complaint in the federal case and adds a rape. It's actually sexual battery is the civil tort. So one of the counts in front of the jury is going to be the rape count, the sexual battery. So that's claim number one. In the meantime, Trump being Trump, he then last year, when all this starts to happen, he goes on Truth Social and he basically repeats all the defamatory things, allegedly, that he said about Jean Carroll in 2019 when he was president, except now he's not president anymore. So there's no way that the United States could be substituted for him. There's no complication here about respondeat superior or sovereign immunity or any of that stuff. So that defamation count, what Jean Carroll does, as soon as Trump does this routine on Truth Social, Jean Carroll again amends her complaint and adds a second defamation charge. So that second defamation charge, based on the statements that Trump said on Truth Social in 2022, is in the case. So the two charges in the case are rape, the civil tort of sexual battery, and the 2022 defamation. The 2019 defamation is not in the case, but I think what Judge Kaplan figures is, however the jury comes out on the two charges that are in the case, that will obviate the need to have a second trial on the 2019 stuff. So what that ends up meaning is this litigation that went on from 2019 to the present, ping-ponging back and forth from a bunch of courts who wouldn't decide whether Trump's denials were within the scope of his presidential duties or not, that probably will never be decided because it won't have to be by the time this trial is over.
So just as a matter of strategy, so my understanding is the assumption is that Trump is not showing up for this, and the assumption is he won't be called as a witness. But if you're Gene Carroll and you know he allegedly did this to you, and you know there are these credible other women, and you know he's admitted it on tape, why wouldn't you have him testify and have your lawyer nail him to the wall?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think their calculation is twofold. The main part of it, Rich, is they believe that it will infuriate the jury that Trump doesn't show up for the trial. They think that it's one of these cases where everybody else who's got an interest here, including the jury, has to show up and sit through this whole thing every single day.
And the fact that jiu-jitsu there.
Yeah, so the fact that he blows it off will annoy them. And the second thing is, it's not like they don't have testimony from Trump because he had to sit for an extensive extensive pretrial deposition. So they have, if you put somebody on.
What they're going to use, they already have. What they would use, they already have.
Yeah, because it's a known quantity. I mean, he gets, he's a charming guy. He could get in there, it could go very well for him. Or, they could hit a home run. But I think what their calculation is, number one, if they thought Trump was going to do that well in front of the jury, his own lawyers would be looking to call him, which it doesn't look like they are. They have what they need for purposes of the case from his deposition, and they're hoping the jury will be very angry that he blew this whole thing off and didn't show up.
So if he's found to be guilty, what happens?
It's a civil judgment, so it'll be it'll be money damages. No fine. It's she doesn't put a damage amount in her complaint, so it'll be up to the jury what damages she gets. And on that score, Rich, I think that the one thing that I think people haven't focused enough on, and this is kind of an inside baseball litigation thing that I learned from Louis Free when I was a young pup of a prosecutor, and that is that a judge can make all the difference in terms of how he treats the case. So, for example, we always thought as the government, if you were fortunate enough to have a case where someone like Judge Mukasey was assigned to the case, it helps the government if you have a judge who in every single case treats it like it's serious business, that it's not a big joke, that we're not here to laugh with the lawyers and act like it's not serious business. That if a judge sort of cracks the whip, acts like everybody's supposed to be on time, expects people to act with the decorum that's expected of people who are in a serious endeavor, that's very good for the government in a criminal case. The defense likes it when the judge, you have a lot of judges who are, they're jocular, they don't always treat it like it's serious business. The trains don't run on time, everybody's late. The jury never knows what time the day is starting or when it's ending. If you got a judge who
National Review editorial meeting
or even a podcast. If you get a judge who treats it like it's serious business, then it's a leg up, I think, for the side that has to prove something in the case, which in a civil case is the plaintiff. Mm-hmm. I think Judge Kaplan is a very good judge. He was appointed by President Clinton in the 90s. He's always had a reputation for being a very serious guy. He had a number of the terrorism cases in the 1990s were assigned to Judge Kaplan, including, I think, the embassy bombing case. So he's a serious guy. He's a smart judge. He runs a tight ship. And I think it's obvious, even though there, you wouldn't be able to point to any single thing in the record, but he doesn't like Trump. I mean, it's like it couldn't be more obvious that he doesn't like Trump, and he doesn't like Trump's whole routine, which brings us, I think, to the fact that at this point, Trump, as Kaplan pointed out to him yesterday, is on the verge of adding to his problems, because Judge Kaplan made a couple of rulings prior to the trial, which judges always do, right, about what evidence is in and what evidence is out and all that stuff. So Trump wants to press this issue of who is paying for Jean Carroll's legal fees. There's this big Democrat donor, Reid Hoffman, who is the founder of LinkedIn. He's a billionaire. He runs some progressive special interest group, and they are apparently paying some of the fees, some of the expenses of Jean Carroll's lawsuit. Carroll's lawyer, Carroll's main lawyer, is a woman named Roberta Kaplan, who is no relation to Judge Kaplan. And she says the basic arrangement here is they're working on a contingency fee, which means the lawyers only get paid if they win. But there are still expenses in litigation, obviously, that have to be paid to prepare for, you know, your presentation at trial. And they say that this group that Hoffman funds, at least the allegation from the Trump team, is that they are paying Carroll's expenses. So Judge Kaplan decided that's like too far afield to be relevant to the case. Well, and ordinarily, lawyers' fees are not something that gets litigated in a case in front of the jury. There's all kinds of issues about attorney-client privilege and stuff that goes to that. So Kaplan said, out of the case. We're not having a trial within the trial of who's paying Jean Carroll's legal fees. Trump is out on social media saying that Jean Carroll is being backed financially by a Democrat political operative. And he tweeted that, or not tweeted it, he put it on social media. He put it up there on Wednesday after Kaplan said that it was out of the case, right? And then there's the other thing, which is when Trump was trying to get this case postponed, one of the things he offered to do was provide a DNA sample. Now, why did he do that? Well, Jean Carroll has the dress that she says she was wearing when Trump attacked her, allegedly. And she submitted that dress to forensic testing to see if they could find anything that would connect it to Trump. I'll politely as possible say, we're not talking about a Monica Lewinsky situation here, but they were looking for any, you know, kind of, you know, hair or something that they could connect to Trump. Trump knew that she came up empty in this examination. So there's no evidence that his DNA would be helpful to the case, because it's already clear that she doesn't have any proof that connects him to the event. So while he was trying to get the case postponed, one of the things he did was he offered to provide a DNA sample, and then they would get testing to establish what's already been established, which is that she doesn't have any DNA evidence. So Kaplan said, number one, that's not very, it's of minimal probative value under the circumstances. And number two, Trump offered to do this after the time for disclosing evidence was over. The court had made an order the parties have to exchange evidence and show each other what they intend to prove at the trial by X date. Trump waited till after that date was over and then made this offer, and the judge denied it. So, of course, he's out there on social media saying, we need to have the dress in the trial. Why won't the judge let the dress in the trial? I offered to, you know. So Kaplan has been very careful, and this is the issue. We're seeing the same issue with the Alvin Bragg situation, where, you know, they, remember with Bragg, they had this big to-do over whether they were going to have a gag order on Trump. Yeah. And it raises all kinds of First Amendment
sure.
and electoral politics issues because Trump is running for president. So Kaplan has tried to be careful about not putting out a gag order that would be unconstitutional, but he did jab Trump a little bit. He directed that the parties refrain from saying anything that would cause a riot or civil unrest. I don't know what on earth he could have been referring to, but it was okay for Kaplan to say that because you're not allowed to incite a riot or civil unrest. Nobody is, right? So basically he told them that they were prohibited to do that which the law already prohibits. But Trump, of course, decides he's going to push the envelope. So he's out on social media saying publicly the things that the judge has excluded from the case. So what Kaplan said to Trump's lawyers yesterday was he's not talking to his public here. He's talking to my jury. Mm-hmm. And I excluded this stuff from the trial. He's got to stop talking about the case publicly. Otherwise, he's very close to the line of jury tampering. And he ended up saying something that was actually pretty interesting. Joe Tacopina, the lawyer, said to the judge, you know, look, I didn't know anything about these tweets. I hadn't heard about them. I hadn't seen them. But judge, here's what I'm going to do. I will go back to my client and I will ask him to please stop tweeting about the case. Although he made clear that, you know, he'll ask. He's not promising he's going to be able to get Trump to do anything. So Kaplan said he hoped that Tacopina was successful because, and this is a quote from the judge, we're getting into an area conceivably in which your client may or may not be tampering with a new source of potential liability. And I think you know what I mean. So what he appears to mean is that Trump is very close to being held in contempt by Judge Kaplan, and that he's treading close to the line of criminal obstruction of the trial. And what I think has Kaplan aggravated is that Kaplan keeps asking Tacopina, is he going to come to the trial? Is he going to testify? And Tacopina is like, we don't know if he's going to testify or not. We don't know if he's going to come. He's very worried about tying up the traffic. But like he really does want to be here. And Trump is on Tacopina's witness list, but Tacopina won't commit to calling him. So from where Kaplan sits, Trump doesn't have the nerve to come to court and actually get on the stand, take the oath and face questioning. But he's on social media talking to the jury, mm-hmm. which, you know, it is apt to get a judge very aggravated. So the dynamic between Trump and Judge Kaplan is not good at this point. And, you know, Trump could be yet again digging a hole for himself because of his impulsive behavior. Gene Carroll would say that's what got them in court in the first place. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Free the Economy, the new podcast from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.